16:14. I subscribe to the acosmic Gnostic view that world does not reveal God. Abolish world, and you are facing God. In a sense, world is a mask thrown forth by God to conceal himself from man, who must then deal with the puzzle which world presents to him. If evil, undeserved suffering, rules world, how can it be the product of a benign mind? But world is not isomorphic to God. It is unlike him, a smokescreen, with which man is not to make his peace, but is to balk against. Yet tantalizing clues, signs of God, shine through the world from the far side. They invade the world and are covertly available to human perception. The golden section is one such clue. Axiom: masks do not resemble the visages concealed by them. If we know that world is a mask of God, the problem of evil, undeserved suffering, is somewhat answered. But why must God mask himself? Answer: man must solve the moral and epistemological puzzles presented to him by world in order to come to life, become disjunctive from what is not him. He can join the world, or he can repudiate it. This is a very serious game, this guessing game. It only serves its purpose if man knows relatively little about what is going on. E.g., if he knows he will be rewarded for balking, he will balk in order to obtain the reward. The test will be contaminated. He must balk with no knowledge of reward. In fact, he knows he will be punished by world, the BIP, so he who gives up his life will save it, etc. This all really presumes another invisible landscape at odds with the palpable one. Two realms, perhaps a lower and a higher, one implied, each with its own laws. The lower realm alone does not tell the full story. In fact, may not even tell the true story, or a part thereof. In the lower realm, deity appears in a debased and trivial or besmirched guise, marginally, like the cheap commercials for Ubik. Only at the end, as in the heading of the last chapter in Ubik, does deity unmask itself, and we see it as it truly is. Thus I say, if deity exists in the lower realm, it will not bear a noble, heavenly, dignified, beautiful aspect. It will be where least expected and as least expected. So there is no use deliberately looking for it. It will have to come to us and unveil itself to us. It could be an old, sick, even dying tomcat, stinking of urine, degraded and humiliated. However, it aids, advises, and monitors us. The world is a one-way mirror. God can watch us, but not we him. 16:19. Aldous says, "The horn of freedom blows in my writing." Note: Brian Aldiss was a science fiction author and critic who favorably surveyed Dick's work in his 1973 study, The Billion-Year Spree. End note. If I stigmatize the lower realm as counterfeit, aren't I rendering a service, and an unusual one at that? Who else has unscrambled world into two realms? Well, Parmenides, for one, the malignant part of which is bogus. God, I have broken myself in this pursuit over 27 years. Critics compare my malignant false worlds to metastasizing cancer. I demand that deity appear or somehow put its stamp on world before I can accept it as anything but a diabolic counterfeit interpolation. We have been deceived for thousands of years. The Neoplatonist, such as Plotinus, knew of two realms. The Essenes, Josephus, report a lower realm of feverish unconsciousness, the poisoned, intoxicated soul. Men like to sleep. 16:21. Axiom: the best forgeries go undetected. On a scale of increasing perfection, there is an inverse ratio to detection. Those which we do detect are signs which point toward the better undetected ones. 1629. The mad god James James began generating world upon world, worlds unrelated, worlds within worlds, fake worlds, cunning simulations of worlds, mirror opposites of worlds. Like I do in my stories and novels, e.g. Stigmata and Precious Artifact, I am James James. I created one world among many and entered it and hid myself in it, but the police detected me, the non-Terran police, and tried to fake me out with the Xerox missive. But I knew it was coming. As soon as tears appeared, they would be sure about me. And I recovered my memory and identity and powers and dealt with it properly and paid them back. My organization helped me. It set off my memories a month in advance. I saw my creator, protecting me. I am hiding here, under his protection. The network voice, she talks to me. I am patched into the network, so I am not alone. Meanwhile, my creator, Zebra, patiently repairs the damage I've done by rebuilding the worlds. He harbors no resentment. All I am allowed to do now is write about what I used to do. In a sense, I am a prisoner, but it's for the best. I learned this from Precious Artifact. I am a mad ex-world generator, now confined, but still periodically mad. I can't die. I am countless reborn metamorphosed. I know the truth about the worlds I have made, that they are not real. I know about Dokos, simulations which will pass any test. They are not fantasy, and they are only illusion to those who take them as real. They are skillful forgeries which will pass inspection. They are indeed like metastasizing cancers. A world capable of splitting its perceived reality into countless counterfeits of itself, however Lem put it. Does Lem know? He has guessed. It is found in my taco stand visionary experience in 1971, which proliferated itself into all Mexico and was real. I generated it, as I used to do, but exiled now, put in a box, and dropped into the ocean. Zagreus. Burroughs is right about the Nova Police and their tracking down their quarry. But in my case, Zeus protects me, Dithrambus. Given a new life with no memories, I was still able to undermine. The worlds are cunning forgeries, and the police are after me. But Zeus will always protect me, despite what I've done, misused my ability. Lem may be on our side, my organization. In any case, he knows. He knew before I did, i.e., before in 274 I remembered. The Nova Police fell here. I assisted in that, but only to a very tiny degree. Tears contained the message, the quarry is innocent, and the police will suffer reprisal. We spring up everywhere, proliferated. The time has come to render this world void, to abolish it and judge Shiva. The police search frantically. The innocent, the wild little ones of the forest, have nothing to fear. My extended hand tells them that. Solemn, Pentheus, die. Felix, happy Dionysus, live. Pentheus, police general of tears, the de facto monarch. 1645. If the above theory is wrong, and there is no negative hallucination and spurious reality laid over the real world, which is quite different than what seems to be, then what has been the use of my writing? Also, why have I been motivated for 27 years to belabor this one theme, including fake memories as an inner analog to the fake outer world. Is it all just foolishness? My writing has to be dismissed, including the Acts and New Testament material in tears and the exculpation cipher, i.e., the good news. And my 274-275 experience has to be dismissed as a psychotic break. And God didn't aid in pulling down the tyranny. There was no inbreaking, as depicted in the tears dream. Everything has to be dismissed. My life's work means nothing. My most treasured experience. And I am, and have been for years, just crazy. Because everything is interwoven. It either all stands or it falls. Such stories as Precious Artifact and Electric Ant and Retreat Syndrome tell us nothing, not to mention the novels. Ubik tells us nothing? And 4 years and 4 months of Exegete? Wasted? 1655. Let's start out afresh. 1. When I wrote Tears, I did not knowingly include any elements pertaining to 1st century AD Rome. It was a totally imaginary future world. 2. The month that Tears was released, I saw a golden fish sign and asked what it was. I was told it was a sign used by the early Christians. At once I remembered that the time was the 1st century AD in Rome, not the 20th century in the USA. 3. 1 month later, amid various unusual subjective sensations, I experienced 1st century AD Rome as present and believed myself to be an illegal secret Christian, with code signs and sacraments such as I later learned were used at that time. I also dreamed foreign words, all of which turned out to be the Koine Greek used at that place and time, although I did not know this. I believed that Christ had just died and would soon return. I felt great elation. I was shown the word Felix in tears and understood it was not a name, but a key code. I did not know what it meant. However, I looked it up, and it means happy or prosperous. 4. When I described tears to my priest, he said that a scene was very like a scene in Acts, which I had never read. I then read Acts and found many elements common to tears. After 4 years of studying tears, I felt I had fully extracted a steganographic message from it. Tears was in fact set in 1st century AD Rome. I can prove it regarding the Acts material. The message, deeply buried, is that Christ has returned and we can't see it. Instead, we see a fake, delusional other world in which 2,000 years have passed, or appear to have passed. I did not put this message in Tears, or know it was there. The Roman world I saw the month Tears was released is the actual world in Tears. Unexplained are, if I did not recognize the Acts, biblical elements in Tears when I wrote it, how come I properly identified them the month Tears was released, and I found myself in that very same world? Why didn't I identify that world as the one I had written about? These questions bypass more obvious questions which more naturally arise, such as, how come I found or believed myself in 1st century Rome, etc.? The questions in paragraph 1 are more astute than first appears. The questions, one question actually, is formally phrased as, if you can identify why can't you identify why? The world of Tears is, cupola for equals, 1st century AD Rome. When I saw 1st century AD Rome, I recognized it. Call it why. I could, upon seeing why, recognize and identify it. Why is the world of Tears? I wrote Tears. When I wrote it and repeatedly rewrote it and later repeatedly read it, I saw nothing in it that suggested why to me. But I later demonstrated an ability to recognize and identify why when I saw it. There is a disruption in the continuity of pattern recognition and identification. There is an ellipsis in, not logic, which is not involved, but something deeper. Person 1, myself, both recognizes pattern Y and does not, i.e., he is familiar with 1st century AD Rome and its customs and is not. He dreams Koine Greek words, but does not, 1, know what they mean, or 2, that they are the Koine, or 3, that the Koine was the lingua franca of 1st century AD Rome, that Acts, e.g., was written in it. This line of inquiry points to two persons, one who knows and one who does not. This is substantiated by the switch of memory from 20th century USA to 1st century AD Rome. The person who wrote Tears used the memories, knowledge of the other without realizing it. This dissociation continued through all the 11 drafts and readings until the memories, personality, and knowledge, i.e., the other person, broke into consciousness the month the book was released. Question: is there a literature on alternate personalities in persons with multiple personalities separated by 1900 years and 8,000 miles? They could not have split off during one lifetime, i.e., at an early age. So childhood trauma won't explain it. Answer: there is no such literature. Question: does the steganographic message provide any clue to the abreactive personality? Answer: the message is the kerygma, proclaiming the redemptive death and resurrection of the Lord, revised. Christ is not crucified, did not depart, and hence is present. The subjective sensations noted above pointed to a confirmation of this. Conclusion: the person has a rich fantasy world. He has dissociated personalities and experiences. Ever since an auto accident, he has complained of periodic amnesia. The hidden message in the novel and the remembering ancient Rome indicate strong unconscious wishes directed towards Christ's imagined return. It is touching that the human hope for a Redeemer could yield such elaborate fantasies. A dearth of real experiences is indicated. Therapy indicated. 1662. K.W.'s right. The BIP warps every new effort at freedom into the mold of further tyranny. 1669. But are you writing something serious? Note the word. Fuck. If they couldn't get us to write serious things, they solved the problem by decreeing that what we were writing was serious. Taking a pop form as serious is what you do if it won't go away. It's a clever tactic. They welcome you in. Look at Lem's 1,000-page essay. This is how the BIP handles it if they can't flat out crush it. Next thing, they get you to submit your SF writing to them to criticize. Structured criticism to edit out the trash elements. And you wind up with what Ursula writes. Like I say in Scanner, our punishment for playing was too great. And my last sentence is, and may they be happy. I got that from knowing what Felix meant. Let them all play again in some other way. And let them be happy. I showed the unfair punishment for playing. Scanner is a study of what the BIP does to you, punishes you, and what for playing, not growing up, not toiling. Like the Christ story, it simply, as I point out, just lays forth cause and effect. I don't wind up deploring playing, just that particular way of playing. So in a way, Scanner is a study of the punishment, too great, for playing instead of toiling, not drugs. Thus the secret, encoded theme of Tears is carried further. Amazing, since when I wrote Scanner, I hadn't yet figured out Tears. Knowing what I know now after 4 years of exegesis regarding tears, what I'd write on the basis of it would be Scanner. How do you explain that? Scanner logically follows tears. If you know what tears is really about. Play is one of the antiphonal themes in Scanner. Play and punishment. What an insight. You play and are punished, and far too severely, as I say, the punishment was far too great. It opens the postscript. This has been a novel about some people who were punished entirely too much for what they did. They wanted to have a good time, etc. The expectation of punishment is a knowledge about playing. You have been taught to expect it. This goes beyond mere worthlessness. This is sin, and God will get you, in all his mundane polyforms. Both communist and capitalist and fascist societies and theocracies teach this. It's called theodicy. It's fucked, like when Mary Lou threw my snuff in the garbage. No wonder the more money I get, the more morose I get. I enjoyed paying the IRS. Shit. The BIP really has me by the balls. 1672. Even if you believe in man's sinfulness, the doctrine of vicarious atonement makes no sense. The crucifixion story says, they punish you and they kill even spotless God who couldn't be in any way sinful. And that is wrong. The story proves you don't have to be sinful to get maximum punishment, death, and humiliation, disgrace. It shows there is no connection between sin or imagined sin and punishment. This is the lesson of Calvary. God himself proved it for our benefit. This absolute lack of connection. The proof was immediately the victim of BIP warpage, right off the bat. So the true message has to be smuggled in subversively, in code. See, Christ came back and is breaking the BIP, not just its power over us, but it itself. Hosanna, shout of joy.